One of the wire services gets an ID on Pete and moves the story that he's a senior operative in one of the larger drug rings. All the networks flash the details, and soon more talking heads appear, now opining on drug lords in the Midwest. Jack's name is mentioned, even though he's managed to stay clear of any legal convictions. Soon the speculation graduates to certainty, and the news analysts spin webs of conspiracy and made-up facts, increasingly convincing themselves of their construction of the truth. The video feed from Jack's machine in St. Louis initiates, but all they can see is a grainy static scene with no sound other than street noises in the distance. However, soon the system alerts them that it detects new noises in the St. Louis feed. Automatically, the video data stream appears in a larger window on David's giant display, and the audio from the priority site turns up while the audio from what they were watching mutes. They hear someone entering the room in St. Louis. A speckled, ghostly picture of a figure, who Mike quickly identifies as Jack, walks past the laptop and over to a TV. He casually switches it on, punches up one of the cable news networks, and sits in an easy chair. They chuckle as they watch Jack learning the news about the events in Omaha. Jack curses to himself, or so he thinks, then turns from the TV and heads for his laptop. On the way, he mutters, "That'll show those fucking bastards not to fool with me." Brings up his email and begins scanning it for messages from his agents about what's happening in Omaha. Nothing. Instead, however, he finds a message with a copy of the video that Jay filmed has been sent to him, anonymously. He curses again, and the guys in Omaha laugh out loud as they watch his fuzzy image on the window and his screen displaying the video in the other. Jack freezes in panic when he sees the video close-ups of his hired killers. They hear Jack mutter, "Fucking Shay, it's time I got that little bastard." "Ooh," they all chorus at once in mock concern over the threat from their antagonist 500 miles away. "I wonder what he'd say if he knew we were watching him now," says Mike. "You know, we can talk to him through his speakers anytime we want. Might give him a bit of a shock, though," answers Todd. "Yeah, let's not give him a heart attack yet. Maybe later," says David. "We need to keep an eye on him for the time being. At least can I write 'all your base or belong to us' across his screen?" "Sadly, he wouldn't get it," laments Jay. "Too bad, really. We really do own him right now. He just doesn't know it yet. He's like a fish in a tank, and we own the tank." Jack instantly figures out that the flambé of crab dip in the video was from Omaha, and that it was Pete's airborne demise. He's not happy that the wire services are revealing that the corpse belonged to a drug dealer from Des Moines. That could be a problem. Jack gives an exasperated sigh and leans back, thinking of what to do next, while his TV in the background continues to retell the story. Jack knows he's lost a lot of troops in the past few days, and this is bad for business. His operation is quickly becoming the laughingstock of the trade. If Jack's not careful, somebody else will be moving in to shut Jack down. Jack knows he has a very serious problem, and he needs a very serious, very final solution. Terminating Pete was just the first course. Now he needs to go in for the final, real kill. Jack pulls out one of his prepaid cell phones and begins making some phone calls. He summons some of his more skillful helpers from the termination department. What he needs are a couple of creative psychopaths willing to do anything, and he knows just the guys for the job. This time he wants it done right, and he wants to make an example so it won't happen again. He makes his phone call and sets up a meeting with Ed and Jim, two guys they will kill just for the sport of it and won't botch the job. All this is watched and recorded in Omaha by the unseen audience. Todd's touch-tone analyzer decodes the phone numbers as they're punched. Then Jack calls Joe and sets up a VPN video conference for later. David says, "Well, it sounds like another onslaught in the works. I wonder what he's got planned this time." "I guess we'll soon find out," says Mike. Time, 4 p.m. For the rest of the afternoon, Todd spends his time analyzing the data that Jay and Mike brought from Des Moines. He continues breaking into networks owned by the mobs, both in St. Louis and around the country. By late afternoon, Todd's rootkits have attached themselves to all of Jack's outgoing messages and installed themselves on the target machines. Subsequently, they spread further, using each newly infected machine's address list, secretly cross-checked with the list being compiled back at Mulroan. With the path now open to these otherwise hidden recesses of the internet, Todd and Jay further upload more spyware onto the infected machines, including keystroke loggers, screen capture utilities, and file capturing programs. Quietly in the background on hundreds of machines, Jay's indexing tools begin to scan files and send back detailed sitemaps of their contents. These are copied and archived onto David's servers on the floors below and cross-indexed with the content being extracted from other machines. Soon a vast interconnected database belongs to Todd and Jay. The main drug network is a multinational VPN, a virtual private network using cryptographic tunneling protocols to prevent snooping or even the detection as to which machines are part of the ensemble. With this facility, facility, the dealers can secretly communicate with one another in real time, normally without fear of detection. Besides email and instant messaging, the system includes multi-point video conferencing capabilities. Drug dealing is a big business with an IT infrastructure to prove it. However, all this security is now rendered meaningless as the rootkits, keyloggers, and spyware spread inexorably from node to node, undetected by the owners of the machines. The rootkits send home to Omaha the decryption keys, allowing construction of the complete network map. It extends throughout the Midwest with nodes to the West Coast, South America, and all the way to Southeast Asia. It is a gold mine of data. With Mike's first-hand information and this backdoor into the organization's data network, the entire operation lies exposed. Chapter 8, Monday, January 15th. Time, 12:30 p.m. Monday afternoon, the automatic audio analyzer system alerts Jay that it has detected voices at Joe's old warehouse. She calls the other guys and patches the sound from the warehouse window transponder to their cell phones in conference call mode. By now, she's also managed to tap into the landlines going into the warehouse as well. But now the action at Joe's warehouse is the video conference on the VPN coming in via DSL. However, Jay easily captures and decrypts the feed at its source in St. Louis. She sees the same screen as Joe does. She transmits the streaming video signal to the other guys' cell phones in real time. Mark and Sid are with Joe. The conference is with Jack in St. Louis. Joe, Mark, and Sid, seen through the webcam, are visibly nervous. Jack begins. Joe, I've had enough of this fucking around. I want that place eliminated. I'm sending two guys up there. I want you to do what they say. Is that clear? Yes, Jack. Anything you want, replies Joe earnestly. First, we need to know about their delivery schedule of beer kegs. Find out who their distributor is. What brands, what size kegs, how many and what days of the week they get delivered. Got that? Yeah, kegs, brands. Yeah, I can get that. Once I get that information, I'll be sending a van to your warehouse with some kegs that will match what's normally delivered. Be careful with these. Don't bounce them around or anything. Make sure you use your best and most talented guys on this. You got that? You bet. I take it these kegs might go bang? You got it. These guys I'm sending will deliver the kegs to the dance club after they attach a little arming device. You'll need to get a hold of one of the beer distributor's delivery trucks for a while so my guys can make the delivery. Once the kegs are delivered, we blow the place up that night. That'll mean a lot of people, Jack. At this point, I don't give a fuck. The more the better. Right now, I want this ended, and I want it ended in a way that is final. Okay, it's your call. I understand that this Shea guy introduces each night's show at around 10 o'clock. Is that right? Yeah, usually. That's what I'm told. And that's when we do it. I'm personally going to handle this one. Got it? Yeah, I got it. Okay, now get me the information on those kegs. Jack signs off and the video conference ends. Jay, however, continues to capture Joe's webcam. Joe looks at Mark and Sid and says, well, looks like trouble. You guys think you can get the information on the beer kegs? Mark says, yeah, we'll get it. We'll figure out something. Good. Get the delivery route, too. I want to know where we can hijack the truck. Let's hope this ends this business once and for all. Okay, you guys, get going. Get me that information as soon as possible. Mark and Sid walk out of the warehouse and across the street to Mark's car. The wind is picking up and the sky looks like it might snow again soon. Chapter 9, Tuesday, January 16, time, 10 a.m. The next morning, Mark calls Joe from his cell phone and says, we got the information you wanted. The distributor is Aramark Distributing, and they deliver on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Usual run is about 10 kegs on Monday and Wednesday, and 12 on Friday. All standard 15.5-gallon domestic kegs of Miller Draft. How'd you get the information? It's pretty detailed. Anyone suspicious? No problem, really. We found the delivery driver and had a few beers with him. Then we broke into his truck while he was eating and looked at his schedule, so that's how we know his route. Okay, thanks. I'll get back to you. Just hang low. Joe immediately emails the data to St. Louis over what he thinks is an encrypted network. Todd reads the email before Jack does and forwards a copy to Lance, David, and Jay. When Jack reads it, he begins making some phone calls. First, he calls Ed and Jim and says be ready to head out of town for a few days, probably Wednesday night. Then he places a call to Denver, where the mining industry makes explosives more readily available. His contact in Denver recommends RDX, Royal Demolition Explosive, or cyclotrimethylene trinitramine. When mixed with plasticizers, it's called C4. When mixed with PETN, it's called Semtex. It's one of the most potent of the nitramine class of explosives. Early Thursday morning, a van begins its 550-mile journey from Colorado to Joe's warehouse in Omaha, carrying three standard-sized, ordinary-looking Miller Draft kegs packed full of RDX. Meanwhile, Jack has had his local tech expert buy another untraceable prepaid cell phone and rewire it so that when it rings, it will trigger a detonator. The cell phone, the detonator, and about a half a pound of RDX are packed together in a black, soft plastic tube about 8 inches long and 2.5 inches wide. The bottom end of the tube is sealed, while at the top end there is a plastic plug from which the cell phone can be removed to turn it on. When the tube is placed between the kegs and the number is dialed, the resulting detonation of the kegs will result in a blast with enough force to bring down 5 warehouses the size of David's club. Jack doesn't want to take any more chances.